Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by MUBI, the curated online cinema. Go to MUBI.com/filmstage and you can get 1 month free of MUBI.
Went down to the River Jordan, where John baptized three. When I walked the devil in hell, said Johnny baptized me. I say, roll, Jordan, roll. My soul will rise in heaven, Lord, for the year old Jordan, roll.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me today, we have Michael Snydell.
Good evening.
Well, you know, as we're recording, yes, good evening. But, you know, for anyone who happens to be listening to this in the afternoon or the morning, good one of those to you, too. We also have,
hello in general.
We also have Bill Graham. Yeah. And we are here today to talk about the film The Birth of a Nation. That is the new film out this weekend, written and directed by Nate Parker, starring Nate Parker. It is the story of Nat Turner's slave rebellion. This is the movie that came hot out of Sundance and has been a flashpoint of many different kinds of controversy ever since.
Yeah.
So this will be A pretty interesting episode, I feel. Whew. And the music we have is from another slave narrative movie that came out. That would be 12 Years a Slave. I love this song.
It's weird to say it's a gorgeous song, but it absolutely
and it's
is.
It's such a powerful point in that movie, which is a movie that I actually rewatched today in anticipation of this podcast.
I wanted to do that, but I didn't make it.
Which is weird, because I did it because you said it, and I was like, you know what's a great idea? That idea that Michael
you
had.
Stole my idea.
and put it into action. Monster.
I stole the idea and then performed it better than you did because
how
I bothered to do it at all. I also read most of Thomas Gray's Confessions of Nat Turner, which was a lawyer who met with Nat Turner after he had been sentenced to death and put his confession down to paper. And that is actually for free online. You can download it to your Kindle, or you can actually download like a PDF version. And I would say that anyone who's interested in this period in history should do that thing.
How long did that lawyer spend with him? Is that information available?
I'm not sure. I'm sure I could look it up. And if you would ask me beforehand,
I just wondered. It's okay.
All right. Before we get into everything, let me remind everyone that we can be found on Twitter at Film Stage Show. You can also find us on Facebook, searching for The Film Stage Show. Find us on iTunes, give us a comment, give us a rating. We love that. And you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And again, we are brought to you by MUBI. Everybody knows by now how much we love MUBI, because MUBI takes the time to curate 30 great films for you to enjoy at any given time. Every day they release a new film. You have 30 days to watch it, and then it poofs out into the ether. But like I said, it's replaced. There are always 30 films there, and you can download them to your phone for their duration of the time on MUBI, so you can watch them on the go. We got some great stuff coming to MUBI in the coming month. We have, this is what I'm most excited about, Horrific October.
Yeah!
Movie.
There's also a Lav Diaz movie if you have 5 hours just laying around.
If a family member of yours is in a coma and you have to sit by them mournfully in the hospital, Lav Diaz is there for you.
Or another scenario that's less horrific.
Yeah, I guess so. So, Horrific October.
If you're stuck at the DMV.
That's a much better one, Bill. Thank you.
Still horrific, though.
Not as horrific as Horrific October, which I'm still trying to talk about, which is MUBI featuring some of their favorite horror films throughout the month. And it actually begins with From Dusk Till Dawn.
Woo!
Yeah.
Which is one hell of a fun movie. Just a great film. So check that out. They also have their New York Film Festival projections series going on, So if you're sad that you can't be at NYFF, is there like a
and who cute, isn't?
Is there a cute way to say that? Is it like NIF or knife?
No, I think, oh, can I we think, start I calling think it knife? Just call it. No, we just call it the New York Film Festival.
All right, fine. Go to mubi.com/specials/projections and see the lineup. And again, remember, you can go to mubi.com/filmstage to get your free month of Mubi on us. Mubi. Tagline pending. Still.
So much despair.
I keep expecting to get an email from them being like, this is our tagline. Say this. You forced us to make a tagline. All right. That's enough fun. Let's talk about The Birth of a Nation. Like I said, this is a passion project film that premiered at Sundance this year. It was bought for $17.5 million by Fox Searchlight. And it is in theaters now. This was going to be a huge Oscar push movie, which is why it was bought by Fox Searchlight. It was a passion project brought to the screen by Nate Parker, who we have enjoyed in films before. Films like Arbitrage.
Beyond the Lights.
Beyond the Lights. I was going to say Nonstop, which is a movie that I can never talk about enough. And he wrote this, he directed it, and he stars in it.
I think it's been 10 years in the making, actually.
Yeah, he has been on the hustle to get this thing made, and he finally did. And we can't talk about it without bringing up the fact that since this movie premiered at Sundance, some items from Mr. Parker's past have come up. This is something that we've been sort of struggling with.
Sure.
The movie is out there. What has happened in Nate Parker's life and the things that he may have done are bad. The allegations against him are terrible. And to be quite frank, his reaction to them hasn't been stellar.
No.
We're going
repeatedly.
To try. Yeah, he has repeatedly failed to offer up what could be seen as a truly contrite apology for what he is alleged to have done. And as the more details have come out, that has become more of a sticking point. And it has become an albatross around the neck of this film.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes complicated.
Go ahead, Bill.
It needs to be said that Fox, for the longest time, was pushing this film as his film. He wrote it, he directed it, he produced it, he stars in it. He is the shining star that they kind of were pushing out until news of this kind of broke. And it's not necessarily news, because this is something that has been in his history for the last, what, I think it's 8 years ago or something like that. Ever since he was
in college.
And it happens that Penn State is involved in that too, which is just a really weird thing. It was from his college life, and they were pushing it very much as the Nate Parker movie, like right. celebrating it as that. And now they've started to swerve and started to realize, let's not do that so much anymore.
So
it's interesting to see.
Yeah, it's just difficult, because when Roman Polanski makes a movie, you can say, oh, this movie was written by this person and stars this person. And, you know, Roman Polanski is the director, but there are other talents involved that may take center stage. This is, as much as it can be, a vehicle created by a man for himself.
Mm-hmm. I need to mention this too, in the same way. In the same way as Woody Allen, there is a strong tension in terms of how the text of this film intertwines. And I will fully admit that I had difficulty separating that.
Right.
I will only be talking about the text of the film, but I will completely say that it is difficult for me to separate the allegations and the way that the film bears out
those
implications.
The reason that I have for bringing this up early is because I had said, you know, as I had to do with Woody Allen's recent work, like when I was made to go watch Blue Jasmine to talk about on this, I usually try to stick to the aesthetics and the narrative and the craft and try to keep my personal feelings out. This is a difficult film to do that for. So there will be points when the allegations and everything that has happened has to come into play.
I think we should absolutely mention if there is something that we're saying where we feel it's important to recognize that as an influence, though.
Yes.
If we're being the most honest.
Absolutely. Which is why I wanted to introduce this up front. So there will be things that we may not like that are completely separate from that. And then there will be things where we'll be very broad and open and honest about the fact that those are playing into our read of the film.
Mm-hmm.
With all that said, with the preamble and the what would you call this? Disclaimer out of the way. Here is the trailer for The Birth of a Nation.
You a child of God. You got purpose. The law put it there, and nobody can take it away.
These books are for white folks. They're full of things your kind wouldn't understand. You're special, boy Nathaniel. Study hard here.
Your slaves sure do know how to behave.
Well, they God-fearing. One of them's a preacher.
People might pay good money to have them calm down a bit, especially by one of their own.
So as we said, this movie follows Nat Turner's life from early childhood to his eventual death. Historical spoiler alert? I don't really know how to handle that, but... Yeah, for anyone who doesn't know, this was the first mass slave rebellion in the United States, and it was led by Nat Turner, who was a...
In 1831.
Yes, who was a preacher, who was taught to read, and was actually brought to minister to slaves, using passages from the Bible, to justify their enslavement. And then... Obviously, he turned around and decided to lead a rebellion, which lasted for close to 48 hours and resulted in the death of, I believe, and I should have had this figure
55 up. People.
Okay, I was going to say close to 60. 55 people. So, that is the facts of the case. This is obviously a fictionalized account. Let's see what we thought of The Birth of a Nation, a film that at Sundance was greeted before it ever even played with a standing ovation and then had a second one when it was done. So, let's start with Bill Graham. Bill Graham, what are your, of course we'll get into details later, but what are your broad all-around thoughts on Birth of a Nation?
So, first and foremost, this film is, right now it looks like it's running 120 minutes, so it's right at 2 hours, right? This film oddly feels incomplete. It feels too short in a way. I think there's a lot of buildup, and the release attention is pretty potent, but it feels like the story was just rushed in some way. I really think some of the performances are excellent in the film. I think Armie Hammer is as just kind of a drunken nuisance is pretty interesting to have as one of the kind of white characters in the film. But for the most part, it just, to me, something feels like it's missing in this film. And I think there's 30 minutes of film that just isn't there. And I'm not sure. I think it mainly has to do with the end, but it just feels too short for me, and it feels incomplete. You know, we can get into more details of some of the other stuff, but that's my general kind of take on it. I didn't it, it, it wasn't it wasn't any kind of a grind to experience. It was largely okay. Yeah.
All right. Michael Snydell, what were your broad thoughts on The Birth of a Nation?
Well, I mean, I think I agree with Bill in broad strokes. I'm probably more quite a bit more negative on this than him. The things I have about this film, and we will get into specifics, obviously, is that this is a movie where I had to keep reminding myself of its historical context, because it is only with this historical context that I was really feeling the power of these images and the way that this was going. It's a very bold movie, and I don't mean that kindly. I absolutely think that given the subject matter, Nate Parker felt emboldened to make these grand, overblown, overwrought choices. And I think the movie is it's frankly a mess. And I think at times it's awful, and at times it's okay. But it was I was frustrated when I left the theater, but I guess the more I think about the structure of this film and the way that it conforms to revenge narratives and, you know, chosen anointed one narratives, the more angry it makes me in how the script is a tool to bring across a vision that isn't even interrogating itself. I imagine we'll talk a lot more about the historical ambiguity of Nat Turner's life. But I was just so disappointed that this is just such a face value, one-dimensional version of what could be such a fascinating story. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm hedging real close to what both of you are laying down. When I got out of this movie, I believe I texted you both and said this movie could use some more Jesus. And I texted the same thing to my wife. And it feels like that's a glib thing to say, but it's really not. I feel like after everything that I've read and I've looked into, and even what this movie gave me, I got to agree with you, Michael Snydell, that,
oh man,
I was like, I'm not going to call him Mike. I'm going to call him Michael. And then I guess my brain just said, ah, let's throw the last name on there too. I have to agree with you that there's so much here, and coming out as this movie does during what is probably the high point of racial tension in this country for at least the new millennium, if not more, there's a really kind of, it's at once childish and very uninteresting play in this movie. There's no, it really is a revenge narrative, and it's made far too personal to stand in for the kind of big ideas that I think it wants to stand in for.
Mm-hmm.
12 Years a Slave was a great film in that it took a very personal story, but was able to expand it outward and make every other person within the story feel like an elemental part of the world, so that even though many of these people we only met for like 5 minutes in the movie's runtime, when they left the orbit of Solomon Northup, you could feel their lives going on. You could understand where they were going. And in this movie, everyone acts as a push point for Nat Turner. And he gets no less than like five speeches about being the chosen one, to the point that honestly, it felt a little bit like the kind of YA narratives that we get a lot nowadays in the movie. Mm-hmm. Turning what should be a man rebelling against a real historical evil into a strange kind of Katniss figure. And mm-hmm. it was not distressing, maybe depressing or disheartening to see that. Especially given the role that religion had in this story,
sure.
but not in this film.
And the very interesting right. ways religion figured into this. Yeah.
Because this is a movie that is specifically set up that it could have addressed a lot of big, bold ideas, but instead it functioned more as like a little bit of wish fulfillment in the strangest way.
I got to say, what this film does, it does something that I think a lot of book adaptations or things like that sometimes try and strive for, but you know, sometimes fail at. But this is a movie where you get done with it and you want to go explore the story more, right? It's not satisfying in the way that a really good book adaptation is, that just kind of says, okay, that was, I feel satisfied when you walk out. You want to know more information about this guy. You want to know more information about the true story of it. And I think it's a failing of the film in that it gives you enough information to kind of tease it, but it doesn't satisfy. And so it's just like, no, I want this story. This real story is so fascinating. It's so interesting. And this film is just largely like, yeah, here's kind of the beats.
And it's not like
no.
It's not like a superhero film where we can like dust our hands off and say, well, maybe the one next month will be better. It's mm-hmm. a real rarity in Hollywood to get a film about slavery in America that doesn't often tend towards trying to give white audiences an out, to give them a place where they can feel like, oh, well, I would be that character. I mean,
yeah,
12 Years a Slave is based on a true story, but you still have characters within it that react with compassion and kindness, and who, I mean, especially when they're up in Saratoga, you know, treat Solomon and his family like people, like they are. This movie is buried like a tick into the darkest underbelly of the South at the time and offers no respite for a white audience feeling discomfort. And that's a good thing. Like, that's a really good thing that this movie doesn't do enough with, because it strays from any sort of emotional complexity or reality. It makes this feel like something that's happening to this man and the people in his life. And it doesn't make it feel like a broader societal and spiritual ill that is still afflicting the nation to this day. And that is a wasted opportunity.
Well, guys, one really strange factual thing about this that I didn't realize until after reading multiple reviews is that this happens in one county.
Yeah.
For the way that you're talking about YA narratives, and, you know, for as much as it overblows the sense of, you know, how, what kind of influence a protagonist has, and that's definitely been a problem with many YA novels, like, if this movie misses the opportunity for so many chances to actually dig into, if this is the same county, like, why not take advantage of that?
Make it feel like, more like a whole world.
Exactly. Like, yeah. He doesn't need to represent the entire South. Like, sorry, this is a very small nitpick, but it reminded me, just when you're talking about the scope and and things like this. And the other thing I wanted to bring up is that I also tried to go to some outside sources. I watched the Charles Burnett documentary about him, and I was struck by what the historian said, in the sense of saying that when white people read about the Testament, they more easily identify with the children. One thing we haven't gotten to is that it's women and children that were being murdered, not only men. Right. So there's a sense of not inhumanity, because there's also a justification if you look at this in terms of its historical context. But I guess what I'm saying is that there's just it's not only a failure on trying to bring out an overall ambition. It's a failure to try to grapple with what makes this story so mysterious and also so cathartic and so righteous and also so uneasy. And those things, if they're in the film at all, are reduced to 10 minutes. Right. And I guess, yeah, it's just a, and that's not even getting into I mean, I have real problems with the direction in this film. I think it's,
yeah, haven't even begun to talk about this film aesthetically, but
I'm sorry, I got off the track, guys, but yeah, I just wanted to bring that in.
What I'd like to add on to what you say is that if you look into this, and again, you know, it's sometimes hard to let a movie that is based off historical fact live on its own. This is a problem that I have had previously with The Revenant and In the Heart of the Sea. But it's always just distressing to me how you can take a character who's so complex and so interesting on the page and then just kind of sand that away and then give gentle nods to that so that you're still within the realm of fact, but without any of the greater complexity to it. I mean, this is a movie that should have been able to make us really reflect on things like religion and cults of personality and how much are we willing to accept violence from a wronged population in retaliation for them having no other option. And sure. In a world where we've seen cops, you know, shot in the streets after other cops have shot unarmed people in the streets as well, like that's a bold, complex, impossible question to ask. And it's the type of thing that art is there to make you have to wrestle with through the safety of remove of fiction.
Sure.
Like, let's be honest. There's a Netflix show out right now called Luke Cage, and it's about a black superhero who is invincible to gunfire and among other things, and he walks around in a hoodie. And
right. Yeah,
this is coming out at the same time that Luke Cage is. This is definitely a film that is speaking towards that narrative of violence, of uprising. You know, Nat Turner's whole kind of mystique is that he is a black man talking to other black people and trying to quench their anger and their frustration with their situation. And sure. I just feel like this film is so timely, and I think that's part of the reason why Fox jumped on this film was they probably saw the groundswell of just how this was going to kind of play out. And it is super timely, but it feels just so incomplete in what it's attempting to do.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's a very weird, you know, there's a very strange divide. And again, we'll get into this. There's a very strange divide between how we're supposed to feel about Nat Turner, how we're supposed to feel about what Nate Parker feels about Nat Turner, about how the other characters are we supposed to view them as, you know, there's some characters who are embarrassingly cartoony in this. Jackie Earl Haley in this is awful.
He's the British officer from The Patriot.
Yeah.
Just this unrelenting evil force that we're supposed to like root for the end of.
And it's interesting that you mentioned Luke Cage, because the one subversive, not the one subversive, there's many subversive things about Nat Turner in general, but this, the most interesting parts of this movie, to me at least, were the brief parts where the Bible became something where he was equal with white people. Where the Bible became something where even as he was seen as a black slave, he was equalized because he also had knowledge of, you know, scripture. And this movie so weirdly acknowledges and doesn't acknowledge that, and plays with ideas about, you know, which Bible verses have double meanings and, you know, which ones are meant to seem very tame. And all of these things are like vaguely there, and the film does nothing with them.
I think it does a little bit more than what you're kind of giving it credit for, but it definitely feels like breadcrumbs more than a satisfying meal. Right?
One drop more than nothing. Right. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Fine.
But that's as much as I agree with Bill. I somehow still feel the like tension and anger that Michael is feeling still.
Sure.
It's just
there's a lot here to mine that this film does a surface job on, right?
Like are either of you two religious at all?
I grew up religious, but not anymore.
Yeah, I am a practicing Roman Catholic, so I got a lot of stuff that I got to work through in my day-to-day life. Guilt and uncertainty is a big part of my spiritual existence. But as a person who believes in the, you know, non-literal word of the Bible, it's hard to have this book that has so many great compassionate ideas in it right alongside things about selling your daughter and when you can put a man to death for doing something on the wrong day. And so to see a movie that has a character who is a preacher who begins ministering to slaves to ameliorate the tension, saying, you know, at once, you know, God says to obey your master or he gets the opportunity to beat you, but also that people who mistreat you will be visited upon themselves tenfold what they did to you. It's a strange dichotomy and kind of force to reckon with. And it would have been great for this movie to zero in on that, especially given the incredibly religious nature of Nat Turner's personality and his ultimate, I don't want to say the word radicalization, but his moment when he decided to turn to violence. Because as anyone who this is going to sound super awkward for me to say, as anyone who truly knows Jesus would tell you, ultimately, you're not supposed to raise a fist in anger. You're supposed to feel compassion for those who do you wrong and live a just and good life and hope for paradise to come once you die.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
this is a man who lived by that, believed he was hearing words from the spirit who spoke to the prophets in the Bible, and then turned to horrific violence. And that's interesting. That's like, we're primed for that. We love people who challenge our conceptions of good and bad. We are the culture that venerated Walter White and Don Draper to hero status, despite their incredibly narcissistic, evil, and like hurtful tendencies. And for this movie to kind of poke that without wrestling with it and offer people just kind of giving him permission,
yeah,
is difficult. Like, you have one slave who was a house slave, you know, dressed up in a suit, carrying around a silver tray, who says, you know, he's a god of love, like, you shouldn't be doing this. And then Nat Turner just says he's a god of wrath too. Yes, that is a dichotomy, but you need to explore that more, because as a Catholic, nothing is more annoying than having to point out that, like, God in the Old Testament, quite a different person than God in the New Testament. And that's just one of those things you got to live with. But this is a person who put that into practice. I don't ever have to worry about that, because I'm never going to go out and try to murder people who are wronging me. But this is a moment for that idea to really be brought into the sunlight and really wrestled with, and to say, even more interestingly, like, this is a good, godly man, and look what this system did to him.
Sure.
Look what it brought him to. But none of that ever really happens.
I think one of the most interesting things about this kind of narrative and what's going on, especially in the Deep South, is that religion was used against slaves to basically justify what was going on, right?
Sure.
And yet, what did they do? They were converted forcefully, yes, but they ended up turning around and embracing the own thing that was used to put them in binds. And it's like, that idea is really strange, and it's really upsetting that you could use religion to put someone in binds and beat them over the head with it. And then they turn around and start embracing religion as well. And it's there's something so strange going on there that this film doesn't really it touches on it a little bit. But man, there is a film out there just waiting to be made about that kind of subject that it doesn't even necessarily have to involve Nat Turner. You know, it can involve any of the rise of
just the complex slave interpretations. Religion. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. This film, it touches on it a little bit. I think some of the things that Nat Turner does in the film, I think, are part of the reason that I don't really understand what is going on. Part of the reason that Samuel Turner, his slave master, kind of turns on him, just some of that doesn't really make sense, and we can kind of dive into that in a little bit. But there's stuff that I think Nate Parker is smartly touching on. I'm curious how much Parker is religious himself, and how much that may or may not have hindered him from really kind of embracing that side of the story of this film. So,
right, because when you read the confession of Nat Turner, it's he's setting himself up as David, as a man touched and spoken to by God, who interprets the signs and symbols and takes what he believes to be not just a righteous but like a divinely inspired path. And there's just a bunch of really interesting ways to take that without turning this into what can perhaps reductively be called a Braveheart story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So aesthetically, let's take a step back from our various issues with perhaps what is un...
Does that include structure as well then?
Yeah.
Because I have some structure things I'd like to get into as well.
Well, we'll get into structure. Let's talk aesthetics, because when I first saw this trailer, I should say, this looked like it was going to be a level of direction and cinematography that is more so like suited for the History Channel. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, trailers are twofold. They are what the creators or the marketing want you to see, putting their best foot forward, but they're also not a fair representation. I will say that the movie is competently directed and at times has
the cinematography,
some,
I would say.
Yeah. Has some decent imagery. There, for instance, was a cut between his childhood and then his mature adulthood that involved his younger, unskilled hands picking cotton, and then mm-hmm. kind of delicately segueing into him picking a lot faster as an older man. And I thought that was both structurally and aesthetically a good choice. There are, at the same time...
We've also seen that so many damn times, though.
I've seen that used as a
transition?
Means of transition.
Okay. I'm just saying the cotton thing was something where I was all right, we're going to go through every beat, aren't we?
Well, I mean, like, I didn't look this up, but this movie takes place in Virginia, and I'm not sure how many live oaks with Spanish moss there are in Virginia. but, you know, the climates that are conducive to cotton, I would assume, be climates that are both conducive to live oaks and Spanish moss. So I was fine with that. But no, as a transition, I thought that was a good, subdued, subtled way to do that. I also think that an image of an ear of corn swelling with blood was particularly good. However, there are shots and inserts in this movie that are comically misjudged.
And I think the only reason he got away with those is because of the audacity of his intention.
Right, which can carry a poor choice like that through.
But I'm saying that, like, people would not say, hey, you know what, this is actually really stupid, so don't do this.
Are we all thinking of the angel that he sees a couple times in the movie?
I don't understand what was going on there. I think one thing that's interesting that Parker has decided in Nat Turner's kind of character is that anytime someone talks to him, anytime a white person talks to him, he's always looking down. And I think it's interesting because it kind of carries over from the young boy, Tony Espinoza, that plays a young Nat Turner, and his kind of almost inability to talk when confronted with anything. And I think it's interesting what Parker is kind of playing with there, but it just never goes anywhere. And specifically, it kind of revolves around his interaction with Jackie Earle Haley, and it starts when he's young and it continues when he's older. And there's some choices in the film that just aesthetically are kind of troubling that Parker continues to touch on again and again and again. The moment
dream sequence, Phil?
The dream sequence is one.
Are we talking about the dream sequence with him in the woods and the child and the people in the ropes?
That's the one that I'm thinking of, yeah.
Okay. Yes, that's what I was thinking of as well.
Great.
But yeah, there's certain choices in this film that I think show kind of a flair for a really good eye, I'll say, for certain ways. I did really like the way that transition scene happens, Brian. Okay. But there are some others that were just maddening in a way.
Yeah.
So,
and I think that I'm just going to put this out there. This is his first movie as a director, I believe.
I'll
look that up as I'm speaking, just to be sure.
Sure.
He did two shorts before this, but this is his first feature film. These are the types of things where, like, you would hope that a person could grow and learn from them. And I think that there, because of what this film is about and the time it's released, there's an, I won't say unfair expectation, but there is a greater expectation on perfection and polish. And given the fact that this movie was made independently by him through, like, the sheer force of his will, you know, if I saw this and then heard that he was getting a better budget next time with a producer and, you know, some people that would give him a hand, I feel like this would be, to me, a fairly auspicious beginning to a directorial career, if only for him to become, like, vaguely workman-like director.
Guys, it should be said that he had some incredible people in the editing room and on set with him. He had Edward Zwick, who specifically was supervising based on his experience with Glory. There was Spike Lee in the editing bay. There was – oh, shoot. I don't have it up. I know Mel Gibson helped with determining scope. Also, the writer of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which is a curious choice in itself.
That is a curious choice.
I'm sorry. I'm not trying to say that I am automatically going to dread when Nate Parker makes another movie, but I am not going to give him that much leeway. It might be his first film, but there are choices in here aesthetically where they are so amateurish and so obnoxiously over the top that I am very worried about his overall judgment when it comes to symbolism, when it comes to imagery, when it comes to editing, when it comes to character development.
The final thing I was going to say is if he gets someone else's script, because
I want to mention the shot I really want to mention is the one on the porch, and it's where a girl is running. It's a young black woman running on the porch and a young white boy behind her, and he has a rope.
It's the opposite way around, but yeah.
Oh, I'm okay. Yeah,
He's leading her.
Was that a boy?
I thought it was a girl as well.
I thought it was a girl. There's like a white girl leading a black girl on a rope.
Sorry.
Noose leash. Yeah.
That is a choice that is it made me so angry because it shows such a sense of I know I'm bringing in other things here, guys. I'm going to say that, but this movie just felt so that it was able to get away with so many things just because of its context. And it made me very frustrated. You know, whether it comes with blinding lights while he's in the prison in the end sequence. There's just so many moments where I'm like, don't do that. That is not good filmmaking. That is, and it's not only obvious, it's insulting. Like, you are reducing the entire plight to this martyr. Like, now I'm getting angry.
No, like I said, one of the worst things for me in this movie, outside of the lack of care or attention brought to the religious aspect, which I think is the most fertile and interesting point, is how much this movie makes this personal when if it really wanted to do something, it would attempt to make it more, not universal, but like more macro. Like don't have his friend and his wife, his friend's wife and his wife be victims of white sexual violence. Like, don't make it seem like those are the things that are pushing him. Make it the fact that that can happen to anyone. Like, it would
that
be
this
more
is a system. Yeah.
Right. And I in everything I read, oddly enough, I don't know if his wife actually was sexual. Well, let's just say brutally raped by a patty roller, which was part of the slave patrols in the South. I don't know if that happened, but if it didn't, and if it was simply added to give justification for him,
that's gross.
Don't do that. Yeah. And this is where I gotta say, like, this is where knowledge of the allegations against him from college really
that's
bummed
why
me
I
out
mentioned that. Yeah.
and made it harder to handle this, because if you were to say this is a man who looked around and saw the dehumanization and the way that the white establishment had, like, basically inoculated themselves against guilt through scripture and through property law, and then you had this man say to himself, the only thing that's going to get through to these people is biblical violence, basically, you know, I will be a plague upon this land. That's interesting. But if you make it a guy who witnesses two acts of rape,
sure,
and then decides, but it just feels like, and it's not even like the movie treats it like this, but it feels like a man who's doing a good thing, I guess, for the wrong reason in the wrong way. And when it gets time to the rebellion, which takes up an incalculably small amount of this movie.
Exactly.
And that's a whole other problem. It's very strange. I could tell that the people in my theater weren't sure what to think of either. I purposefully went and saw this movie.
It feels almost like a postscript.
Right. I purposely went and saw this movie at a theater around my house that I know. I live in PG County, Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. This is a very heavily African-American area. So I specifically sought out a theater that would have a heavily African-American audience, because this is a movie that speaks to things that are way outside of my experience. And I was interested to see how people would react to it. Mm-hmm. And you could kind of tell that it was hard for the people in the theater to know what to think either.
Yeah.
And so terrible things are happening to people, but it wasn't any different than whenever anything bad happens to anyone in a movie. And then when the rebellion happened, there was a weird sort of silence that attended all of the violence.
Yes.
And it wasn't because they were, like, gasping and struck dumb with this and not sure how to feel about it, but just because you weren't brought in enough. And the violence was so quickly done. And then it gets to a Braveheart-style hand-to-hand battle that is pretty thrilling to watch in a bad way, and that ends in a way where people in my theater were upset, and I don't know that they knew precisely, like, what it meant to the greater narrative. And we can get into it in spoilers, but I think the movie, it has a bunch of related incidents that it never plays as being part of a whole.
Well, it's so strange that, you know, we can get into this before spoilers, is that it's fair to say that the entire movie is a build up until the uprising.
Yeah.
So the whole movie is stacking the deck against these characters that we're not going to feel too bad when they die, with the exception of one or two. But it's structured in a way where, okay, we're going to go to, you know, there's the sexual assault, but there's also the violence, which is numbingly boring. In the sense of, you know, they go to a few different plantations, and it's powerful enough just for them, for Nat Turner to see how these people just how they're living, and they're in a different they have a different quality of life than the people on the plantation that he usually lives in. And that's powerful, but that's not enough for the movie. It needs to hammer home that, no, guys, there's really horrible things going on, and we need to literally bring it right in front of you, right in front of not only the camera, but bring it in front of Nat Turner. Like, yeah, it's
it's going to feel weird to say this, but I've got to do it. There are things that he witnesses that in no way should he be around for.
I was thinking that same thing.
Like, there's a sequence
standpoint. Like, what is
Samuel takes him to one too many places where where they're like showing him things, and you're just like, no, why is he there?
Right. And he's not and, to them. He's just
And what's weird is that the escalation and the way that it's plotted out and the way that each new place becomes a little more of a horror show also feels very distinctly insincere. It's not a good choice. Like, it would almost be better to start at the worst, you know, to really like hammer that home, and then have him go to a place that's only slightly worse than his own, but to still see the way that these people are reacting and know that it's not someone, you know, force feeding someone in the most god awful way possible. It's someone deciding to feed people less. It's someone doing less. And just like have it start at the worst and then have it work its way down so that he realizes that his comparatively comfortable life is still wrong. But again,
that would have been so much better.
Hero revenge narrative that this movie is doing, which I think is, again, its most glaring flaw.
Because we haven't even talked about, the sexual assaults are hugely a problem already, but we haven't talked about the fact that Nat Parker meets his wife Nat Turner meets his wife in a way that is played, that's almost played as strangely as the final act of violence.
Yes. Yeah. I don't understand here.
I would love for you, Michael, to go into this.
It is a meet cute at a slave auction where a woman is severely, she's haggard, and she's whatever atrocities she's gone through, she is at the end of her rope. And I'm not sure how we're supposed to read it, but Nat Turner is watching this slave auction, and he's horrified that there's these gross, piggish men who are, you know, literally
grabbing their junk.
Yeah, and eye raping her. Like, it's very gross, but it's just as gross that Nat Turner is also watching this and prodding his master, Samuel Turner, Arnie Hammer, to buy this woman because he's trying to convince her that it's that she would be a
good gift to his sister for her marriage.
But it's also like he has googly eyes for her at that moment, and it's like from there, that is a good encapsulation of the extent of how much this is Nat Turner's story and not a larger story.
And that's a huge problem. And then the way that she is treated later in the film, it's just a continuation of that. And it's a continuation of, and this is an old school Hollywood problem that has been in plenty of narratives. It's that the women are often seen as the property of the men they are associated with. And so when
so that they love them, happens, but yeah, sorry.
Well, when a violation happens, a man is reacting in the same way he would as if like someone hurt his dog. It's a gross thing that Hollywood has been doing for a long time, and I think that there's, what is it called? It's called fridging, when like yes. a woman is there yes. and then is yes. harmed solely to advance the narrative.
Yeah, it started in comics.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't start a comic. That's from. Where the term yeah. came from. Yeah.
And it's a, again, like in any movie, it would be less than ideal, but in a movie directed and written and starring Nate Parker, given what we've heard about him, it becomes a little more distressing and a little harder to ignore as a necessary evil for moving a story along.
It's even more egregious when there's not, it's not like there's numerous other subplots that are going on. It's bizarre how straightforward this film is in tracking Nat Turner story. It's not like there's other things going on that you can say, okay, this is a small part of the movie. It is incorporated into the main linear fabric of the entire film.
Right. And it's a weird thing because it is the primary motivation, it seems, mm-hmm. is these yeah. two sexual assaults. But what's weird is that when he finally begins gathering people to begin this rebellion, he cites the fact that, you know, for every line that's in the Bible that says that they can do this to us, there's another one that says they shouldn't. Interesting idea. Great log line for a film to then take and explore, but that's pretty much the long and short of it. And it makes it seem as though this man who has been reading this book and preaching for most of his life has only now really struck upon that, and only as a justification for his desire to right the wrongs done against the women in his and his friend's life.
Yeah.
Which is problematic.
And I'm sorry, this is only vaguely related, but I wish this movie was just more challenging. I wish it did make me feel more uncomfortable. I mean,
yeah, that's what I was saying.
I mean, you were saying, like, you know, we've said we've had to precede a few of our statements saying that, you know, as white men, it's very difficult for us to put ourselves in the shoes of what many of these people had to go through and understanding their experience. And yeah, I mean, the final sequence is, I was having complicated experiences with it only because we so rarely see things that, yeah, just show white people dying. It's so unusual that we would see a reversal of this narrative, but that is the only challenging thing in this film.
Well, I think one of the things, and to kind of step it back real quick, one of the things that I had an issue with, and this is another issue that happened in Game of Thrones last season, not the current season, but last season, with the rape sequence of Sansa. Spoiler warning, if you don't watch Game of Thrones and you're not up to date, but yeah. when Nat Turner is looking at his wife who's been just mauled, it's his emotion that we see. It's yeah. him crying.
Yeah,
the camera
literally
at
swollen
him.
To the point that she can't emote.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And this is, again, it's bringing up, again, Brian, you know, it's like a showcase for his emotion at that moment. And it's like,
which, do we even want to say that was a good performance? I mean, like, I feel like it was.
Oh, it felt a little overblown and overwrought, but it felt like,
it's nothing.
Are we talking about Nate Parker here?
Meryl Streep all the time. Yes. Nate Parker's okay. performance in that moment. I mean, I feel like
I think he's bad in this movie. That's me, though.
I think that there are moments where he's fine. He has that one speech on the porch, and that was pretty rousing. And then in that moment, it was a push pull, sure. because it really was like what you were saying, Bill. Like, that is a great performance from him, but this isn't something that happened to him.
Yeah. But it is at a certain point supposed to be meant as, you know, a spiritual transmission. I think this is what that's trying to be. And that is that's an admirable goal.
Yeah.
Of that personal nature. I mean, we are criticizing that, but I think I would say the film is relatively upfront about wanting to have that personal nature be a serve to communicate, you know, a much larger message. I don't know how much we can. I mean, we can talk about aesthetics and things like that, but I don't know how much we're actually getting into the weirdness of how involved Nate Parker is in this film when we're criticizing how myopic it feels.
It's going to be tough to separate.
Yeah. Because
do we want to jump into spoilers or are we still kind of talking around the edges?
The one thing I wanted to say to Michael's point was it is we've talked about how myopic this film is and how personal it makes it for Nat Turner. And, you know, through an interpretation, you could say, yeah, this guy maybe was just doing this personally. But I don't feel like this movie has that interpretation. I feel like it's saying that he's rebelling against a system, but it's only doing that through personal things happening to him. And I feel like that does say something about, obviously, its primary creative force being Nate Parker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would not suggest going to see this movie. I know that people have talked about, you know, we're going to boycott this movie because of the allegations that have been leveled against him in the past and all of his terrible responses to those. I'm not about to make that moral judgment. It's a really ugly, horrible thing. And I just, you know, just from the basic level of an artistic piece of work, this isn't really worth going to see. So, you know, I don't even have to say, it's like, it's a shame this was made by someone who has a rather unfortunate dark past, and, you know, it would be hard to wrestle with that, but you don't have to, because it's not particularly good and it's not particularly thoughtful, and that's, I guess, fortunate, I guess, for people who might be interested in it. It's nothing that you need to do. I would say, I told my mother, watch 12 Years a Slave and then Braveheart.
Yeah.
Like, you know, that's, you're getting two fantastic films in the place of this one. Of course, that is a much longer thing than going to see this one, but yeah, I don't see much of a reason to go see this, which is, again, unfortunate, because like I said, we don't get to see many of these kinds of stories coming to the screen, which is hopefully something that will get repaired.
Sure.
As, you know, movements like Oscar So White kind of force the hand of the industry to become more diverse. And so maybe one day we will get the story that this incredibly complex historical moment deserves, but this is not it.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have kind of said that is a main reason to go see this, right? It's made by a black man. It stars a black man. It was written by and it's like, okay, but is the film any good on its face? And if it's not any good, I think more than likely this is a story that, look, if you want to say Hollywood didn't make this, okay, fine. Nate Parker certainly had the hand behind it. But I think Hollywood is going to see this, realize that the story isn't complete, not in this format, and say, we can do this better, you know? And so I think more than likely Nat Turner's story will be on the screen within the next 15 years, I'd say, easily.
Nice. What I would say is I would not recommend the film, but I will say in a very strange way, it's led to some of the best writing this year. Mm-hmm. All this week we've been sending pieces to each other. So I think if you're
Slack without plugging Slack again, our Slack chat has been filled with great film writing. And
if you are interested in criticism, there are some great pieces out there. Just to plug a few, Vincent Cunningham's New Yorker piece.
Yes.
The Birth of Nation Isn't Worth Defending is excellent. There's a Nation piece called The Birth of Nation is an Epic Fail. There's a really great slant piece by Matt Brennan.
I'll say this. So sure. while we're plugging film criticism about this film in particular,
listen to the film stage show.
So why are we ultimately seeing this film? We knew coming in that the furor out of Sundance had been tempered dramatically by the time it's already arrived in the middle of October, right? So we knew going in that this film wasn't as well received as it kind of initially was. I think this is one of those rare opportunities for people to see a film that isn't a critical darling, that is got a ton of attention. It's something to talk about. It's something to talk about in a way that there is legitimate criticism that can be levied against it. And why is that possible? You have to see the film to really get some of those things. So I think in a way, while we're saying don't watch this film, I would say you have to watch this film just to be part of this narrative, you know, and it sucks to have to be a consumer of something that isn't ultimately all that good, right? It's like, oh, you gotta consume this to then be able to talk about it, right?
That's how I felt
but
about,
it's not very good.
That's how I felt about Ghostbusters, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
Which is it was funny because I also thought of that when you said, like, people were saying you have to go see this because of representation and diversity. And it's like, yeah, but if it's not a good film. But there's an added level to this one, obviously.
Sure. So, because there wasn't necessarily really well-written criticism about Ghostbusters and, you know, things like that. It's like... No. This film had a ton of buzz.
Right.
Yes, this film had a ton of buzz around it. It's finally here. I think it's worth watching in that way to understand why when people talk about it and say it isn't very good, that it's not just, oh, it's critics talking shit about a movie, you know, and it's like, no, go see this. Then understand why we're criticizing it. Understand some of the things that we're talking about, because I think there is a good story to be made out of this. And I think film criticism is kind of a beautiful thing in that it can take a film like this and explore it maybe better than it did itself, right? Yeah. So if you're reading really good film criticism at times, it can explore those subjects better than the film itself does. So I think that's kind of a worthy
which is definitely the case for that New Yorker piece.
Sure. Those pieces I mentioned, they all hint at a much more optimistic future, which is what I really wanted after this, you know, hearing, you know, seeing really clear-eyed strong criticism. It's a reminder of how great we could be in exploring these subjects. And for whatever reason, this film is just, I have a difficult time recommending it, but Bill is absolutely right that there is something to be said for being a part of this conversation, which is very important, you know, even a year after Oscar So White, that this conversation has evolved as much as it might look like from the outset that, you know, we're going a step backward if this is something that was raised up at first.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. So let's get into spoilers.
Yes.
I don't know how long we'll spend in this, but there are a couple of things that I definitely want to talk about. One of which is something, sure, I already brought up. It was the final assault on the armory at Jerusalem, which culminates in two things that are not great for me. One is the mano a mano with Jackie Earl Haley,
which, yeah,
was just that whole Hollywood revenge story thing. Like I said,
it's interesting though, because we're supposed to feel this vengeance that Nat Turner is kind of meting out to Cobb, and yet Nat Turner doesn't if I'm not mistaken, all right,
he has no idea.
He has no idea.
Yeah.
That this is the man that brutally beat and raped his wife. And it's like, yeah, so he has this beautiful kind of like motivation, right? Like, right, like, okay, look, it sucks in kind of a storytelling way, but it's like, okay, I understand, right? Yeah. And it's like, cool. And he tells her, I am going to avenge you. And he says that very clearly. And she's kind of begging him not to. And
up until the point, like, that he says that God told him to.
Uh-huh. And,
which is another thing that's not explored.
We see that sequence, and then life moves on for a little bit. We don't ever see, yeah, for like 15 to 20 minutes of the film's narrative, which is a long time, we don't see her again. And the next time we see her, her puffiness has gone away, and you know, she's still got scars and things like that. But it's like, oh, okay, did we just forget about her for a little while? Like I time and I don't understand. Yeah, time in that particular sequence is very difficult to track, and I just don't understand, yeah, how he can be so righteously angry in that moment, and then we don't see her again. And it's like, it's a perfect encapsulation of exactly what you were saying, Brian. It's fridging. It's, here's my motivation. We don't need to deal with her anymore.
Right.
You already know my motivation now. And it's like, no, she's still a human character in this film. She needs to be interacted with. We need to see her kind of heal back. We need to see that Nat Turner visits his wife again before her face is not puffy anymore. And it's like, yeah, we don't. And it's like, I don't understand what is going on there, that he decided, that Nate Parker decided to write that as a narrative kind of whole. And it feels completely mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
Well, he actually spoke in interviews about how he decided that he was not going to show that, I don't know if gang rape is the technical term, but
say yes.
Is that right? Okay.
I would say yes, yeah.
Okay. He decided that he was not going to show the gang rape because he wanted to focus on the pathology of the aftermath, which is, that only adds to what you're saying, Bill, of how mind-boggling this was, that he made the decision that he wasn't going to show the physical act, which, that's fine in itself, but that implies that he thinks that he adequately included Cherry's character processing that event.
No, yeah, which is just awful to think that he thinks that he did that well. And yeah, is another thing that I guess we should put the little disclaimer on, is something that you have to think about in relation to the allegations against him.
Sure.
Absolutely.
I'm also going to say right now, for anyone who's listened this long, there's a reason I'm not saying precisely what the allegations were, and it has nothing to do with respect or subtlety or sensitivity for Nate Parker, and it has everything to do with what happened and then what the aftermath was for the person who brought the allegations. So there's that. No, but the other thing I wanted to talk about was I had said that the people in my theater had a very wide array of reactions to the end of his assault on the Arsenal at Jerusalem.
Did you guys have cheers?
There was like, it was weird because people would be like doing the whole almost like a church where you go like, yeah, along with the preacher when he would be talking. But then when he started his violence, there was some real like, ooh, that's a little rough. But then when he got to the guns, they were kind of happy. But then when he opened the thing and it was filled with rocks, there was a woman who literally said, oh, no. And then, you know, the fusillade starts and there's a cannon. And I guess it's weird because, and this is what I was saying about things in this movie feeling not of a piece, because if you are upset at what is happening to these people as they sleep in their beds, then you shouldn't be wanting him to get guns. You shouldn't be saying, oh no, when he gets it. And it's not an instance of the movie making you feel conflicted about your own feelings towards what's going on. It's the movie acting scene by scene against its own ideas and self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a huge problem for me. I think another problem that the movie...
Wait, how do you guys interpret Nate's choices there? I obviously there's not a right or wrong answer, but I'm genuinely curious what you guys think.
For like the whole of the rebellion?
Or for the sake of argument, yeah. Let's do...
Because the rebellion is the most important thing in this movie. It is at once a cathartic for this moment in history, 2016, idea of what should have happened, while at the same time being a very visceral and real horrific incident for the people who were victims, because it's important to point out that even though this movie only shows about three murders, all of whom were slave-owning men in their, like, 30s to 40s, women and children were massacred during this.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't show that in the movie.
But no, they show Penelope Ann Miller, don't they? They show Penelope Ann Miller getting an axe to the face.
I don't remember that.
Elizabeth Turner?
Yeah, I don't.
His sister. I'm almost sure that we see an image of Coleman Domingo, of Nat's friend. I'm almost sure that we see an image of an axe in her face, or not in her face. The way that the violence is shot in this is so strange. In the sense of sometimes it's kind of sober, it has a sobriety to it, and then sometimes it's even before we get to that final battle at Jerusalem, there's even a weird I think it was Peter Labuza who described it in a great way and described it like the early scenes in The Shining where Jack Nicholson is starting to lose his mind.
That does it. But I don't know, it's weird because it feels like he knows moment to moment what's a theoretically effective choice, but he hasn't really sat down and wrestled with his own feelings towards what's going on. And so he can't direct ambiguity, so he's just going to direct each scene differently. For instance, there is a point at which a young boy is part of their brigade and is wholly on board for the first minute and a half, and then they get to one of the slaves who's a part of their band, his former owner's house, and he goes in and he kills some people, and then he chases a guy out, murders him, and then decapitates him.
Mm-hmm.
And the boy runs away, and when they kind of chase the boy down to the plantation where he is, it's made fairly clear that he has told his former owner what's going down. And so a number of, you know, white slaveholders with guns repel this group of 20 or so men because they're not willing to get into a gunfight yet because they don't have guns. And it shows the boy huddled behind a wall with a couple of the white slaveholders, you know, plugging his ears and looking shocked. And there were people in my theater who reacted like, oh, this guy betrayed them. And I don't think that they understood that, like, he just watched someone get decapitated. And I think that's a fault of the movie, because in Django Unchained, the explicit, almost comedic violence against the slaveholders was fine. It was meant to
be. It's like watermelons exploding.
Right. It was meant to be an overly dramatic, like, operatic catharsis. And in this movie, like, this is striving for some level of realism. Like, that would be a horrible thing for a kid who is mistreated to have to see. And then, no matter how much he's mistreated, he doesn't want that for the people who mistreated him. That's, to my mind, almost a more, like, a really interesting character moment that, unfortunately, the movie has no time to delve into. And that's a lot of the fault of making this rebellion somehow not the bulk of the runtime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Bill.
So, I hesitate to even bring it up, but I'm going to go ahead and go there. There is a film that I really enjoyed on an aesthetic level immensely called Zero Dark Thirty.
Sure.
Came out a few years ago. That entire film was a build up to the final sequence, right? And it was thrilling, and it was sickening in a way. And it was
a Rorschach test.
It's a weird film to watch and then see the execution of that final sequence, because aesthetically it is thrilling, but what's happening in it is also kind of it's emboldening in a way. And this film could easily have made a final 10-minute, final 20-minute sequence that was just as powerful, and it accomplishes like 10% of that.
Yeah.
So it's not necessarily the criticism isn't necessarily it doesn't spend enough time doing it. It's what it's doing is often so by the numbers. We've seen this before, situations that it just feels ho-hum, and it feels like a whimper, where this film really should have ended in this kind of bravado moment of a man that turns against his own slaveholders and has in a way this kind of righteous fury, and yet does these horrible things and witnesses these horrible things that his own fellow rebellion people are doling out to these terrible people. And it doesn't really deal with a lot of those kind of consequences.
Right.
And the consequences that it does ultimately deal with is told in like, a little postscript, and you're like, whoa, what? Like, I can't believe you built up to this moment and this is what you're ending with. Like, you gotta tell me more. You got, like, even the postscript is such a whimper. It doesn't give you any information. And it's just like, no, there's so much more that you could give me here that could be so much more satisfying aesthetically, but also just in the way that the story is being told, the ultimate nuance of the story, it doesn't do anything with it.
You know
so
what, Bill,
it's not necessarily
it's interesting.
Go ahead.
What you're saying, it would make me more interested in a narrative that begins like the day after the rebellion is put down.
I want to see that.
This movie makes a big point about how like he was dismembered and flayed and all these awful, awful details of what happens to his body because they didn't want him to have a legacy. His immediate legacy, his immediate result from this was getting hundreds of other slaves killed out of fear.
Mm-hmm.
And that is at once obviously a very terrible choice made by the white slaveholders and, you know, gives you some idea of, again, the system that's in place. But it also kind of lets you know a very interesting thing about how these things usually end. If you're not successful, you have made life harder for everyone like you.
Mm-hmm.
And it was weird that the postscript didn't wrestle with that at all. It said, this guy tried to fight the system and the system bit back hard. But it doesn't grapple with the fact that the way that he chose to fight the system was ultimately fairly selfish.
Yeah.
He was the last of all the rebels to die. In the movie, he comes and sort of turns himself in, seemingly as a way to make...
It took 30 days to find him.
In a cave alone.
Yeah, how does that not go into the movie?
Right. In the movie, he turns himself in, is beaten by a group of people, and then soldiers have to step in to, like, save him so he can be hung properly.
Kind of powerful, actually. I kind of liked that.
Yeah, and that's interesting and fine. In reality, he was found by a single man and turned himself in without incident. And, I mean, like, you know, again, dramatic license, that's fine. That made a point. But there's something... I can't remember what I was going to say now. There's something off about that. There's something about that that I don't like how they seem to have begun and ended with the idea that this is a man who fought back and didn't grapple with the consequences of that.
Mm-hmm.
And what that
and didn't grapple and didn't grapple with it. with the idea that okay, if he visits his wife, who isn't dead at that moment. No, if Nat Turner, right? If people knew that he was the one that led the rebellion, she would be dead. There's no doubt in my mind that she would be wiped off the face of the earth, right? Because they would want to take out their anger on someone specifically. Right. And that would easily be his wife.
She would be a good surrogate until that time.
Yes. And so that whole motivation, it's like, oh, he gets to whisper to her, you know, and it's like
ghost like.
Well, and OK, so the film, what it does is it touches on this idea that Nat Turner is really good at playing hide and go seek. Right.
Yeah, and it does. Now that you mention it, that's a weird thing. I haven't really.
And so it plants that seed early.
Yeah, when little
and
Sam
then it
is
pays
like,
it
I
off.
Give up, you win.
Yeah, and then it pays it off, and it's just like, oh, geez, really? Like
speaking of,
really?
Speaking of Sam, I want to talk about Army Hammer, ridiculous name. His character, whose name is Sam. He begins as a fairly sympathetic character, and then his farm is on hard times, so he's like, you know what, yeah, I'll take Nat, and Nat will preach to other people's slaves for money.
And he is very hesitant, hesitant.
Super
at first.
Hesitant about it, but then he does it. There's a couple things I want to touch on. First, there's a montage of Nat going and preaching, and Army Hammer's hand being handed a consistently higher denomination of money, which, oof. And then he starts drinking, Sam does, And Sam, who has been to this point a fairly... There's a great moment in 12 Years a Slave, which I'm sorry for continuously bringing up, but I just watched
That's
it.
That's right.
No, it's good.
So there is a character in that movie, Master Ford, played by Benedict Cumberbatch. It is the first person who buys Solomon. And he also buys a woman who had two children, but he is unable to purchase her children with her, even though he tries. And this woman is crying, like, nonstop every moment of the movie from that point on that she is there. And Solomon at some point flips out on her and says, like, you have to stop crying. And she says something along the lines of, you know, you sidle up to him, you cuddle up to him, and you make yourself a good slave for him. And he attempts a justification. He says, you know, Master Ford is a good man. And she says, he's a slaveholder. And he says, given the situation, and she says, given the situation, he's a slaveholder. Like, the circumstance doesn't matter. He's doing something that's morally wrong. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have here with Sam. But Sam slowly becomes not a good man under the circumstances. And there's a very strange point where I think it's Nat's grandmother says there's nothing worse than seeing a good man broken by the system and turned bad. Mm-hmm. And it seems like she's talking about Nat, but the next cut is to Sam drunk in bed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like there's a super interesting idea there that I'm not like with that kind of cut, the movie had to be doing it on purpose, but I don't feel like it wrestled with it enough when it came time for Nat to murder him.
Mm-hmm. Because that really does kind of, for me, it comes out of the blue. And part of the issue that I have with that whole turn of events is specifically Nat baptizing the random white dude that comes upon his it's not even his farm. It's his slaveholder's sister's farm, I think.
Sure.
I don't.
Yes,
it's like the farm next over or plantation or whatever you want to call it, right?
Yeah, Elizabeth gives him permission. That should be said.
And I don't understand his own motivation there. If okay, so let's bring it back to two things, right? He knows he is a black slave preacher. He knows he's in a gifted position to even be given a book, acted like he has some intelligence, right? So he knows he's in a gifted position, especially since he's already visited a lot of other plantations, a lot of other slaveholders, and seen how they treat some of their slaves. And he knows that he's in a better position, right? But he also knows... Okay, so then there's the religious aspect, and he says something along the lines of he can't wait for a white preacher to baptize this man.
Right.
And I have a lot of issue with that because I'm just like, wait, why can't he? I don't understand the motivation for him as a black man in that situation. What does he ultimately think going to happen?
This but is also, the problem, Bill, with the movie not, as I said, having enough Jesus. I mean, like,
uh-huh.
The movie really needs to sell him as a man of God, but it really makes it seem like his job is to be a preacher. But no, this is a guy who felt called by the literal spirit that spoke to David and John the Baptist and all these other prophets of old. He believed he was a prophet. He believed he was touched. Like, in that situation, a man comes up and says, the white churches in the area won't baptize me, and I've atoned and I need to be saved. This guy's going to say, yeah. Like, this is an awful thing to say, but especially given our modern sensibilities, Nat Turner is a bit of a religious zealot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. That's good. That's something that the movie should have done. But I think a lot of your confusion in this moment is the fact that the movie doesn't give him enough of that. And it's weird because what first made me interested about this movie was the idea that this would be a movie that really wrestles with Christianity's place both in the institution of slavery, but also the abolitionist movement. The abolitionist movement was deeply Christian.
Yep.
And the movie doesn't do that enough. It barely does it at all. And it really just, it kind of just uses it because, let's be real, guys, there's some lines in the Bible that sound great when you yell them. Like,
yeah.
It really did.
There's some beautiful,
like,
beautiful stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah. there's a brilliant scene in The Leftovers that's Kevin Garvey reading from the Book of Job. There's Pulp Fiction, Ezekiel, whatever. I mean, the movie seems to use religion, and this kind of bugged me a lot, and I'm not sure if I really made my feelings felt in the previous one. It uses it more as an affectation than a real character choice, like a real thing that's happening in this man's soul.
Yeah.
And that's a problem when you have a guy.
Amen.
Thank you. when you have a guy whose job is to twist the rose that lives in his heart that gives him joy in order to continue the enslavement of others, when that's his job, when that's what he's being asked by his master to do, that's, especially if that's something that he feels is right, and then for him to turn on that and, you know, strip the rose of its petals and use it as like a thorny switch to strike back against the people who are after him, that's crazy compelling. And this movie doesn't do enough with that. It doesn't have the faith of its convictions to make this a truly spiritual story. So you should start at him being supplicated by religion and then move him to moderate compassion and then have him just go full force to violence in the other direction.
The, like, first scenes are deeply misleading in that way.
Yeah.
It
believes that revisiting is as good as having a through line, and it's just not.
And the hallucinations are another thing. I think the reason why I'm not jumping in here is I honestly don't think there's even enough in that spiritual component to even talk about what it's trying to wrestle with, because it feels so incomplete and like such a character attribute that's only a tool of the script.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's another thing that this is going to be, we've been talking for quite a while.
That's all
right. But I think that this will be a good way to wrap us up while still touching on pretty much everything we've spoken about. The movie ends with a young boy watching Nat Turner hang. We zoom in on that young boy's face. We have a kind of cross-dissolve morphing thing. And then we zoom out and we see that this boy is now part of one of the all-black regiments fighting in the Civil War. That, to me, is really, really bad, because it is conflating what Nat Turner did with, this is one of those things that's, it's from a moral standpoint, you know, as a Catholic, killing anyone for any reason under any circumstances is not a good thing. I think that's pretty obvious. There's a difference between personal violence and state violence. The Civil War is what you could call violence of the state. It is a war. It is a moment during which two sides say, we are going to visit violence upon each other to make a final choice, pretty much. It's two warring ideologies that have said, talking ain't gonna work, we just gotta fucking kill each other until one side has more guys alive, and then that's the side that gets to make the choice. And
yeah,
it's a very different thing to come to that and have people say, this is it, this is the moment, this is what I can do now, I can finally take up arms and fight for this ideal, and then to say that one of them was inspired by non-state violence, a slave uprising, that, again, is super complicated and not well enough explored in this movie, but that left women and children dead in addition to the slaveholders, that's a bridge too far for me.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw that happening and I was like, that is troubling. Now, if you were to do something where, like, these stories were told in parallel and this is a kid who, like, maybe came close to doing that, but then pulled away and then joined up with the military, and then you kind of saw how Nate Parker gave him the idea that you could fight, but then, like, something else gave him the idea that you had to wait for the moment and do it under a certain set of strictures? That's not what I'm looking
for. Yeah, strictures, I think, works there.
Yeah. I mean, that would be interesting, but it's also still weird. It's just, there's something about, like, it's like if someone watched, like, Manson go to prison and then decided to go fight in the Vietnam War. Like, that's, it's really weird. And I don't say Manson lightly. I mean, if you look at the two men at their, like, historical root, you can see that they both had a kind of pseudo-religious cult of personality around them. One of them went out into the desert and was advocating a race war, and one of them was fighting against a system of enslavement. Obviously, one of those men holds the moral high ground, but they're coming from the same poison plane. It's just, for a movie that is so grounded in a story of violence, this film doesn't really grapple with that in any way that's thoughtful. And that final moment where we see that boy making a charge in the Civil War as a grown man just really hammers home how little thought went into this and how, I can't even say ambivalent Nate Parker's feelings are, just like how confused they are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a film largely at war with its own motivations, and I think you said that earlier. This is a film that keeps rounding back on itself in a way, and it's like, because, like, for me, I'm thinking of the sequence when Nat Turner visits his then crush in the middle of the night, and I'm like, wait, Nat grew up watching his own father get attacked in the middle of the night while having, like, a pass, right? And it's like,
oh, so my God, I never made that connection.
And ultimately what ends up happening to her, she's in between, right? She's just far enough outside of the plantation that she gets attacked. Or I say that that's their justification, right? They could have justified anything, right? But that's their justification, is she ultimately gets attacked for being in between. And he's going to ride up on a horse. Can you imagine if they came across him on a horse in the middle of the night, what they would do to him? And it's like, so that's like the own film's internal logic just doesn't make any sense. Why would he do that? And she's so surprised, and it's like, she would be surprised, because that is a dangerous as fuck thing to do. It's a very stupid thing to do. And it's like, but he's going to do it for love. And it's like, no, in this world that he lives in, that is too dangerous of a choice to just make lightly. And the fact that he rides off into the back and we just cut to another scene, I was wanting to see him ride back. I was wanting to see him look around kind of in terror,
right,
as he was moving backwards. Because, and yet they just cut to a different scene.
Yeah, that scene isn't played as like, oh, he loves her so much he's going to risk everything to go finally kiss her. It's like, oh, yeah, he's just going to hop on his horse and go.
Well, there's a weird, I mean, I guess we didn't really talk about it, but there is a weird lightness in this for a period.
Yeah.
You know, like it's
right in the middle. They show one wedding that you're I was kind of confused by. I thought it was mm-hmm. I thought it was Nat Turner getting married, yeah. and then it wasn't. And then she
comes into the church and he says, "Good Lord."
Yes. And they all laugh and you know, yeah, there's another sequence with him.
Yeah, because this is your typical Hollywood story, and that's where we kind of lose the sheen of importance that has been foisted onto it. I mean, 12 Years a Slave, and this is something that I talked about with Bone Tomahawk, actually, oddly enough. But 12 Years a Slave and Bone Tomahawk have this similar thing that I've grown to appreciate in movies, where you can be showing me two scenes that are diametrically different in tone, but are very mm-hmm. much the same in craft and tenor.
Yep.
And so, even though in 12 Years a Slave, you have scenes of people cutting down sugarcane, picking cotton, playing a violin as a free man, as a slave, being whipped, you know, meeting their family, all of these things are filmed with the same hand. They feel of a piece. Same thing in Bone Tomahawk. The scenes with the humor and the laughter and the camaraderie are filmed with the same sense of purpose as the scenes where the troglodytes begin to horrifically murder people. And that helps to feel the change better. You feel as though you're of a part, and your emotions keep the same bedrock. If you go from mm-hmm. a scene of romantic comedy and then suddenly find yourself in a horror scene, you're not connecting the two in your mind and in your heart and in your soul.
Yeah.
You are adjusting for the expectation of that scene, which is a problem. And it's a problem this movie has, amongst the many others that we've talked about, which we didn't talk about. Song choices, which are uninspired.
Uninspired's kind, Brian.
Obvious? I guess obvious would be a good one.
Punishing.
Flight level obvious needle drops. Suicide Squad-esque. Yeah.
Whoa.
Damn. We hopped on that bone at the same time. I'm ready to end my statements. If y'all have other things that you have we haven't talked about.
There's one other, you know, I couldn't help but think of Selma quite a bit watching this as well. Because, you know, I know that everybody didn't like Selma. It's got a very oblong structure, and it takes an unusual, not necessarily conventionally cathartic view of that story. But looking at that film, there's such a richness in how it's presenting an icon and. It's just it's hard not to look at Birth of a Nation, and it's exactly what you're talking about, but it's sanding off those edges over and over and over again. And I want to find, you know, at Nat Turner, I want to be angry or confused with him. I'm going to the same well. Yeah, it's just I was thinking quite a bit about Selma, and I'm wishing this was more like Selma, because I felt like Selma was actually genuinely trying to challenge our understanding of someone like Martin Luther King, who is someone as well who has a very complicated context in history, in the sense of while his legacy is obviously positive these days, there are some who still consider him a radical and consider what he did to have a controversy to it. A subversiveness to him. And there's so many other ways to handle someone like Nat Turner. And this is the one we chose.
Well, it's the one that actually got made. I mean, like, you know, it really doesn't feel like the system chose this. Obviously, Nate Parker fucking strove and scrambled, and, you know, it's regardless of what he did and how he responded to that coming back up, there's something admirable about his lack of compromise in trying to bring his vision to the screen, because no one would touch it.
Mm-hmm.
And it is unfortunate that someone else couldn't have done it, both from a moral background kind of thing, and also just from an artistic side. It's an act of will to bring any film to the screen, and a greater one to do something like this. And it's a shame. It's a shame, and it's an even greater shame because we don't know when we will see this story or any story like it again. But hopefully, as time has gone on, and like we said, you know, Oscar's so white and everything, maybe this will become something that we can look forward to every year. It won't be three Holocaust films vying for it at Oscar time. It'll be two Holocaust films and a narrative about oppressed minorities in America's past. You know, we love those Holocaust films because they give us a clear-cut enemy and a different country to deal with, but like, why not turn that on?
Those films are about resilience, though. Yeah. They're not about... obviously, they're extraordinarily violent, but they are about the triumph of spirit over violence. It's not about vengeance. It's not about... the righteous anger is there by virtue of the history existing. It's...
Again, Quentin Tarantino comes to help us out with this one, because we do have at least one about vengeance.
This... So one thing that I think we haven't mentioned, and it's a small detail, but I think what it does is it puts into context kind of what I think Nate Parker was ultimately kind of trying to do with this film. He had very high hopes. I've listened to some of the things that he's said about this film, about he hopes it inspires people to do certain things. And, you know, look, this is a film called The Birth of a Nation. And if you're not aware, there is a 1915 film that is a silent film originally called The Klansman, but it's been retitled and it's well known by The Birth of a Nation. And it is by D.W. Griffith. This is a film that deals with the KKK, right?
Yeah, it lionizes the Ku Klux Klan.
Yes. So this is a film that he chose to...
This title.
Yes, to take the title and slap it on his film. And I don't think he did that lightly.
Yeah,
I don't think he did that.
A bit of a
yes, yes, improper verb. Yes,
but it's
he took that name, and this is his ultimate ultimate product of it. So I think if you listen to a lot of what our criticisms have kind of been, and kind of take it on a surface level, and are like, why are we kind of angry about this? Well, he ultimately put it in the crosshairs of, let's talk about this and let's take this subject matter very seriously, right? You don't title your film The Birth of a Nation with this subject matter and do that lightly. He went to film school, right? I believe that is why he was at Penn State. He was in film school at Penn State. He knows the history behind that, right? And, you know, it wasn't like someone told him at the last minute, hey, did you know? No, he knew, right? So if you listen to a lot of this criticism and you're like, man, they're really harsh on this, he's elevating it to where it's ultimately asking for it to be talked about, criticized, looked at, and viewed under that kind of lens. It's to be that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know,
that's a great point, Bill.
Very well said. And I think that, you justifying the now 2 hours that we've spent on this is a perfect way to to say goodbye. That is The Birth of a Nation. It is in theaters everywhere now. And we just spent almost 2 hours talking about it. So, yeah.
We had some feelings. It's okay.
We did. We didn't repeat ourselves. I feel like we did a good job. If you'd like to tell us your feelings about Birth of a Nation, find us on Twitter at Film Stage Show. Find us on Facebook, The Film Stage Show. Email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. And find us on iTunes. Let me remind everyone that we are brought to you by Mubi. Mubi, the streaming online cinema. Mubi's awesome. We love Mubi. It is October, and we are giving you a free month of Mubi. All you have to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage. And remember that if you sign up now, you will get to live with Mubi all throughout horrific October. I'm excited to see what horror films they bring to us, because Mubi loves the independents. They love the foreigns. They love the classics. And I am just... There's so many good horror films out there, especially from a long, long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I almost started singing American Pie, but I didn't, so that's good. So we'll see what Mubi does all throughout Horrific October, and you can be there with us. Go to mubi.com/filmstage. Whew. All right, guys. As if we haven't spoken enough, you know, if the people still want to hear more of our thoughts on things, let's tell them where we can be found. Bill Graham.
You can find me on Twitter at CableBFG. You can also find me writing about movies on The Film Stage and also FreshFiction.tv.
All right, Michael Snidell.
You can find me watching way too many horror movies at Twitter on at Snidell. And you can read my writing at Filmstage, Paste, and other fine places. I'll have an interview with Kelly Reichert this week and a review of Fire at Sea.
And you can find me having my own mini Steve McQueen, the director, retrospective on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. That's going to be a laugh-a-minute thrill ride. And you can find me writing on thefilmstage.com. I don't think I have anything up there now, but I will soon, probably. And I will have my interview with Hannon Townsend up any day now. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. And tune in next week. Hallelujah, Roger, I roll. My soul arise in heaven, Lord, for the year when Jordan rolls. Hallelujah, roll.